Hey, man, Brian, we're back again.
Hey, Charles, how are you?
Good, how are you doing?
Pretty well.
So what's going on today?
Well, first, the first thing I need to say is welcome to the Hair Club for me. this is my friend Sam Drucker.
Okay.
And he and I worked together on actual code. We actually wrote code together years ago.
Really?
Yeah. We've known each other for a long time, had a lot of fun. And I'm here today to ask Sam to educate me on the Entity Framework. My last contact with the Entity Framework was several years ago. I did some foundational theoretical work behind it, just kind of try to figure out what the math behind it was.
Brian's kind of our resident mathematician, guy who keeps us on the straight and narrow. He's a guy that you know, shows us all the things that are wrong before they actually go wrong. Whether we choose to listen to that is sort of a different story.
But if I say it's wrong, I can prove it.
That really turns out to be valuable.
Very cool.
Entity Framework has now become a big-time offering. It's there's a whole industry around it that's setting up, and I just want Sam to tell me what did that little thing become? That little exercise in set theory became something.
Well, that exercise is that set theory is still, you know, probably 99% the way that you left it, Brian. It's the set theory thing we're talking about is the actual data model itself, which turns out to need a little bit of magic to enable all this other stuff to happen. And the entity data model, which is the model that this is set up to, all of this runtime and tools and functionality is associated with, the way we set it up has turned out largely to be what we needed. It itself is still an extension to the relational model.
Right.
You can still compute strong equivalences amongst the operations that you do to the data on the graph.
So it's a higher order. There are higher order equivalences. Not only can you say that two relations are related, but you can say that the arrows between the relations are related.
Exactly.
This is very important.
This is something that, you know, Peter Chen had posited, you know, 30-some-odd years ago, probably
kind
78.
Of informally. Basically,
well, you know, pretty specifically, but not to the level of probably a semantic proof that we went to in building this. And in fact, we had Peter Chen out for
I did a radio interview with him.
That's right, a radio interview with him. He came out and spent almost a week with us here talking about what we'd done, how it was being implemented. And we had actually gotten his attention because we presented I think a couple of papers at the ER conference last year based on the Entity Framework work and the Entity Framework tools that are coming out next year. So it really is a codification of that. But the way in which we did it mathematically has come out in the sense that those same things let it still describe these higher level concepts like inheritance, relationships and associations, composition, in terms of that core relational model, which gave us a functional composition of the model itself, which means that it's still subject to query processing, which means all the good database stuff we ever do still works.
And it also means that link works.
Right. It means that link works very naturally because you're still expressing a relational algebra over data.
Function composition is the magic secret sauce. If you can compose functions, that means you never fall off the boat, and link is guaranteed to work.
That's right. So we get the foundational mathematics of relations and the foundational mathematics of what we've done with link across the company.
Right.
And, they meet exactly at the same spot.
Now, that's beautiful. One of the toughest challenges for me, and I know I broke my pick on this several times, is doing the cross product of inheritance with all of these things. Because inheritance, at first glance, is this grotesque thing with polymorphism and shared functions and, you know, what's going on there. Trying to boil this down into simple mathematics that can be combined or composed with the other simple mathematics of relations and functions, that's tricky.
It's very tricky. And I think, you know, it's one of the probably three or four trickier things that separate the EDM from the relational model as we've known it for Rosen tables for, you know, 30-some-odd years.
Right, right.
And the key thing about inheritance is it is one of the bigger modeling concepts that we had never transplanted in the database world. And,
yes.
You know, in some sense, the history of all the OR mappers and that people have used, particularly ones that are built sort of piecemeal, not for the all-encompassing problem, run afoul of. You can pick some translation of inheritance into a relational algebra, but you might not pick the one that's best all the time.
Or you'll get some kludges over on this side.
Right. Or you'll pick one which makes it easy to read the data into objects, but not one that makes it even right. possible to write values back into the underlying rows and tables in a systematic way. You can always write code to do it, but that's error prone at scale.
One of the things that I found in looking into this is that there's this whole historical thing called object-oriented databases, which was a beautiful theory.
Right.
But not relational at all, really.
Exactly.
And when you try to merge object databases, well worked out but limited,
yep.
with relational databases, well worked out but limited, you get a train wreck. And that's OR.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, really, you think of the OR middleware that's out there, they're really sort of limited cases of the general problem of that object databases ran into. And, of course, that all evolved from Smalltalk 84 converging.
Absolutely,
yeah,
beautiful.
Anyway.
The pointer swizzling and object identity is the secret sauce. You get primary keys for free, and then you don't have to worry anymore.
Right. Well, it turns out that, you know, that that misses the point
yes.
of modeling in a very specific way, which is that when you model things that into objects that have abstraction functions greater than identity, something
yes.
more complicated.
Yes.
You know, when you're adding semantics over and above the values of the data, what you're really doing is you're only making it possible to interpret the values of that data in the context of the object it was created in.
Right.
Right. And yes,
that's by design.
Something about identity, it's by design. It's yeah. it's called encapsulation, of course.
Exactly.
Information hiding. You know, it is one of the great benefits, of course, you build these really strong barriers. Mm-hmm. What unfortunately it also means is that you're building walls around the ability to interpret the data itself.
Yes.
And it turns out that encapsulation is just diametrically opposed from doing any sort of set-based operations
yes.
against
yes.
data in that format. You insert these arbitrary computations.
Mm-hmm.
Once you insert those arbitrary computations, you break your strong equivalences
right.
at the mathematical level.
Right.
And you can't read from them very efficiently. Mm-hmm. You can't write to them very efficiently. People have known this for years, right?
Yes. I
mean, people have stored calendar data in databases or not in objects for a long time, and calendar data is decidedly non-relational. You have exceptions to reoccurring meetings.
Right.
You know, you've got all sorts
right.
of grotty relational problems. And they really, it's just an example of how once you have those behaviors that you're using to enforce encapsulation, you really limit the value that you get from the data en masse.
Maybe, correct me if I'm wrong, but the object way of looking at things is really kind of an encoding of abstract data types as opposed to relations.
That's
in
right.
other words, you just say, look, my calendar objects have a certain set of behaviors, and I'll discipline my code around those behaviors instead of disciplining your code around the structure, which is what relational does, and that adds the behaviors on top as constraints or stored procedures or whatever else.
Right, and it's never quite fit right to
yeah.
do that part of the layer.
I mean, you can do either. You can do your job in either style,
right.
but the styles don't mesh.
That's right. That's exactly right. You get that great divide,
yeah.
Sort of what they mix there. The fascinating thing about that is, in the database world, you know, we've learned that the data and the databases far outlive the actual applications.
Oh yes,
far
yes.
outlive. By you know that,
and
data,
they're worth billions.
They're
of
worth billions, and you know, by
you can't break them.
That's right.
Not permitted.
That's right. And we're talking like an order of magnitude difference in the lifetime. I mean,
and no product offering that broke the slightest thing in a database asset would fly. Nobody would pay money for it.
Absolutely.
Quite the opposite.
And it's kind of funny because at the start of relational databases, this was like one of the prime values of having relational databases, is it removed the ability to have your code littered with all the stuff about where the data was, right? All of the things that sort of bogged down the code of cell hierarchical databases was the fact that you had to encode the actual pointers in the data in itself.
Oh, yeah.
Relationally, you pull all that stuff out and say, hey, we've got this smart thing over here. It's going to optimize your actual query. You're just going to talk
yes.
about it in terms of relations.
Yes.
And, you know, the counter-argument is that no one would ever understand how to do that, which, you know, was sort of true, as it turns out.
It's still true,
you know,
now.
Still very
why
true
we have
today. It's why we're still bridging that part.
We
but
still
it's still
have,
better than we were.
It's why we have job security for DBAs.
That's right.
They're the guys who put in the spade work to figure it out.
That's
and
right. And in some sense, all we've done with the EDM and the Entity Framework, which is a sort of set of runtime stuff that implements it in the upcoming .NET Framework release, is we've taken that one step further. And now we can not just do rows and tables, but we go one step higher in the level of abstraction that we offer to people about how to understand their data. And we do that by not going all the way to objects, but by adding these structures like inheritance, like associations, references, composition. And those are all things that you do in objects.
Yes.
But we don't do everything that we do in objects.
Right.
I think it was Bertrand Meyer's, the first edition of the Eiffel book said, hey, what's an object-oriented language? Well, there are these 14 things you have to be to consider yourself object-oriented.
Right.
Well, if you think about where the EF goes in terms of modeling, it goes to probably 8 of those.
That's still pretty good.
And then explicitly not the rest of them, because those are the things that lead you down that encapsulation.
And then you get stuck and you can't do relational models.
And then you lose your ability to query queries, set-based updates, all that good stuff.
All right.
So it goes to a very sort of very carefully chosen point, you know, where we get more structure, and that raises the level of abstraction that we can present to people who have to write programs against this stuff. So, you know.
Okay, good. This brings me to another theme, and that is, who is the target audience? What kind of programmers do you expect to use this? I mean, in my mind, I see the world as divided between database programmers who sling SQL all day long, and then you've got object programmers who sling .NET all day long, and then you have this sort of gray area in between where some of the .NET programmers begrudgingly go into SQL with the tools ADO, and then you got the SQL programmers who begrudgingly go into object programming by doing stored procedures with SQL CLR. Is it the gray area that you're targeting with Entity Framework, or is it either side, or is my picture of the world completely wrong?
Well, I mean, we'd like to change some of the nature of that partitioning.
Okay, good.
One of my personal beliefs is that if you look at what's happening in computing, there's a real explosion in the amount of data in the world, which means, therefore, there's an explosion in the amount of data that any given program has.
Every click, every keystroke is stored somewhere in some adware base
whether it's records that are generated by processing that happens online, whether it's pictures, images, you know, we can go into the media streaming thing, which was really not the same field, although there's some interesting things to think about there.
Right.
Point being, the amount of scale of data that people have to think about when they're writing these programs has changed. That what's really happened is almost every programmer who's writing any sort of viable application, you know, outside of the one or two man shop writing, you know, little utilities, that kind of stuff.
Sure.
Good old NASM programmers.
Yes, right.
That's where I started. Everybody's dealing with more data.
I still have my NASM disk in my drawer. I don't have a floppy drive on my computer to read them anymore, but anyway.
So I think that those partitions will start to break down. Everyone is dealing with a massive amount of data. I mean, even if you pick up, an XML document and you break it down to attributes and elements, you know, they're not, you know, two-page any files that we're talking about with XML anymore. We're talking about a gigabyte XML document.
Yeah.
If you want to break those out into, you know, the fragments and start to deal with those fragments in a natural way. I know I said XML, we started with relations. You know,
objects, relations, XML, everybody's got to deal with all of this mess.
Even the simple line of business app that's just going to pull up expense reports. Yeah, okay, we can say the grids will never be more than 1,000 lines in expense report.
Yeah.
Right? But, you know, that was 10 years ago, 20 years ago.
Heck, you got to deal with all this complexity. If you want to put a box on a browser that says type in your name, you got to do ASP.NET, you got to do XML, you got to do .NET, you got to do SQL, you got to do 4 or 5 programming languages.
Exactly. So I don't want to overblow the complexity, but, you know, fundamentally, all programmers need to deal with more data.
Yeah.
And so what we've tried to do is, in the Entity Framework, and Entity Framework, EDM, from a terminology perspective, the EDM is a conceptual model.
Right.
The Entity Framework sort of incarnates that conceptual model in a data access stack.
Okay.
Right. So it means you can start using the EDM, you can start using those concepts, building those models, get value from having spent the time building those models at the runtime level and at the tools level right away.
So let me just clarify this. I can use this. I'm an ordinary desktop .NET programmer. I wake up, launch Visual Studio, and I can use this.
Yeah.
Now, I'm a database programmer. I launch SQL Server, and I have some stuff for creating shared stored procedures.
Right.
I can also use it there.
Well, not in the current release.
Okay,
that's an extra release environment for us.
Yes. But it is planned.
It's
something you want to be able to do.
We did actually sit down and try to build out our 3-release plan before we started down this.
Well, that's the practicalities of shipping software. You can't do everything that's conceptually interesting, and you got to prioritize.
You have to prioritize, and you have to, you know, you can't You have to ship stuff. I mean, you have to give it to customers.
You do?
Oh, you really do. I know it's an odd thing to say.
Yeah, we're actually an actual company that actually ships things. Right?
Well, even if you let the business part of it go, there's no way to get it right if you don't give it to customers.
Absolutely.
And let them, just,
pound on it, criticize it, and complain. Yeah.
So I have a question, because in our last conversation, Dr. Beckman, you are a doctor, right?
I certainly am.
But I call you Brian, but doctor, you look like a doctor.
Yeah. Today.
So, why did you choose the object model anyway? Because I thought you were mentioning in functional programming. I know this is a little bit of a strange kind of diversion, but in functional programming, data is the object, right? I mean, that's
the
core component.
In functional programming, data always comes in as function arguments.
Okay.
Beginning, middle, and end of story. You have no choice. Now, you can hide it under monads.
Okay.
Or hide it is kind of the wrong word, but to streamline it using monads. And that's a very beautiful theory.
Sure. Would that work over this model?
Well, the confluence of object-oriented programming and functional programming is not completely worked out. Mm-hmm. You have these hybrid solutions out there like Scala and F-sharp that are extremely interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And, for practical purposes, that's where we go today.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to say that functional programming... I don't want to be religious about functional programming as the only way to write programs. It's a great way to write programs. But so is object-oriented programming,
mm-hmm.
and so is Mazin, and so is SQL. These are all great ways to write programs. What we're trying to do in our data programmability effort is make all of this stuff easier and more sensible.
But
which means gluing it together when it makes sense to do.
So one of the consequences of this this discussion really that's been going on for a while is we're not religious really about the purity of our functional programming environment or our object programming environment for data or even our data environment.
Mm-hmm.
There's tangible value in having a model that follows the relational algebra. It means a query processor will work. That's that's really pragmatic value. And so what we want is we want enough structure so it's easier for people who start from the object-oriented world, which is about 99%
probably
of programmers in the universe right now, to approach data.
Because,
all of those transitions where they're writing, you're writing a program, you have to issue some calls to the database, you start looking up the SQL in some textbook, and you realize you need the resident SQL expert, that's a huge loss right there when you just have to completely switch. So what we're trying to do is increase the accessibility of all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Link gives us a ton at the language level.
Mm-hmm.
The Entity Framework is a way to use the plumbing underneath something like Link, or even traditional SQL for that matter, and make the common parts of that abstraction come up through the plumbing. Just less work for the guy who's trying to write a program.
So, but what is shorter code?
What is inheritance? I mean, I'm trying to think about what does inheritance mean in the context of a database? So you're saying that...
Well, I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
So you might have a customers table, right? And, you've got the ID of the customer. You'll have
that's your primary key all the time. Yeah.
Right, your primary key. You might have a foreign key that refers to the address information for the customer. Here's a billing address, here's a shipping address.
Two customers might have the same address, that's why it's foreign key.
Exactly. You might have a number of other fields that are just the value themselves, right? It might just be I'm blanking on a good example.
Well, we've got customers. You might have a department or
Yep, there we go. The simple ones, the ones you don't need much interpretation for.
Right.
And you might also have a field that has zip code. If you're writing a order processing system, you might care about whether that zip code is in the same state as the person who's running the order processing business. Because if it's in the same state, you have to charge the guy a tax. Sales
right.
tax. If it's not in the same state, you don't have to charge the guy.
This is a
tax.
Really big deal, figuring out your taxing jurisdiction. It's a source of constant churn in databases because the laws change all the time.
It changes. So what you might want in a system that's going to do that a lot is you might actually want to pull that out and model a customer, a taxable customer, and you might want to model a tax-exempt customer. And what qualifies for tax-exempt, what qualifies for a regular customer you're going to charge sales tax to? That is a detail of the model. It has nothing to do with the guy who's just trying to write the code that gets there.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, what usually happens is there's some query he knows mm-hmm. some fragment of a query
yeah.
that applies the filter, or usually the filter plus the join that gives him whether or not it's one of those.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got to remember to spell that fragment right every time he needs to refer to that distinction.
I see.
So when he writes the report, you've got to refer to it in the same way. When you write the update logic, not only do you have to refer to the query to get the values to set up to change, you have to remember the inverse of that when you go to update those fields.
Yes.
And basically, what it means is that every programmer in the world not just has to know query, but they have to know the theory of normalization.
Yes, right.
Which is just hard.
It's just plain hard.
It's just plain hard. And even if you know the theory, every DBA in the world is going to change the normalization of the instance of their database. Not change it, but they're going to select a normalization.
Exactly, and they'll denormalize
That's
parts
right.
of their database on purpose.
On purpose, mm-hmm. right, and they'll tweak it. And that is stuff that happens outside of the control of the average application programmer.
Right.
So what the easiest way to think about the value of what do I get about adopting the Entity Framework today is mm-hmm. I get the ability to say, what the normalization is. And so, if you're dealing with...
And you get to say it somehow in terms of inheritance? Just to try to link this back to... In the case of you...
Right. Well, actually, all the things
the picture you
about.
Painted was a customer and then two specialized
right.
types. And in an inheritance modeling language, you would say, well, my taxable
right.
customers are a subclass of my customers and my non-taxable are blah, blah.
Exactly, okay. right. And you know what the relational level
And in SQL, I got to do this query that you said,
right.
and I got to remember all these details.
It reminds me of the days back in the 80s before we had widespread use of object-oriented programs, right?
Right.
You get people who look at something like C++ and say, why would I use C++? I can do it all with macros and
yeah.
just pick
right.
these discriminators out of these structs and
sure.
I'll just pretend that stuff is hidden. And you can do that with SQL, but that's the kind of clunkiness that you feel when you're trying
right.
to sort of translate paradigms. And that's what people
the
do
language
when they
is
do those
bigger
things.
Than the constrained sublanguage that you want to use.
That's right.
And it invites you to
it
make
just,
mistakes.
Right. It just makes it easier to get
exactly.
mistakes because things get spelled with a couple hundred characters as opposed to 40.
And then when you hand it off to the next poor schmo down the line, he has no idea what you did.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
And he breaks everything.
That's right. And some of the we give the simple examples there. Some of them get more complicated. Even things like you write a sales report, by salesperson, right? Well, it's not just a salesperson object that has all the information about the salesperson. Some of it comes from the salesperson table. Some of it comes from the employee table. Some of it comes from the contact table.
Right.
And you have to remember that three-way join every time.
Every
you
time.
Just want to print stuff about the salesperson.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but if I have relations somehow as first-class notions in my
you
world...
Can, if you have inheritance in particular, you can collapse that everywhere to curse the application code.
I meant relationships.
Relationships.
I said relations. I meant relationships.
There you go. There you go. It's complicated.
Yeah.
Even if you know it.
Sure.
So anyway, what we get at then is the EF is a part of the .NET framework that lets you use that model in application code that runs. That's the first incarnation of the EDM that we see.
Okay.
The other thing that I think you brought up, Charles, is the object-oriented model.
Yeah.
And really, we think about those in different sections. There's the EDM itself. There's the ability to express those models.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a question of what set of APIs do I get over that model?
Mm-hmm.
With the Entity Framework, there's an object API. So you get a customer object. It's a regular CLR object. It has
mm-hmm.
all of the fields that correspond to the things you specified in the Entity model.
Mm-hmm.
Once you add inheritance, those things we talked about in the Entity model, they're very close to being objects. It's very easy to see a correspondence between the model itself and objects in the
mm-hmm.
regular CLR sense. But it's not the only API choice that you have. We have another project called Astoria, Project Astoria,
mm-hmm.
which takes things in the model and actually renders them as REST fragments
okay.
that can be sent over regular web connections.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
There's no object to that API. It's
yeah.
it's literally pulling things out in an XML fragment that corresponds very directly to the entity model itself. You do gets to get the values. You do post update the values.
Sure.
Both directions work. It
sure.
works off the same model, the very same model that you build, but you get different API choices and different programming models that can fit into whichever of these models you might be using for your general application development. It might be a composite application, might be a local UI app.
Well, let me put my finger on something very specific right here. You said we would have an object of customer type, roughly.
Mm-hmm.
That's roughly what you said. And that would mean that in my CLR program, I would have somewhere something that says class customer. This is very different from a universal representation for objects, in which I would only have something that says class object, and somehow customer, the customer-ness of it is something generic, maybe
right.
stored in a string somewhere else. And these universal representations target a completely different kind of programmer Those are the people who are writing generic tools.
That's right.
They can't afford to have class customer baked in. They have to have something about class class. They have to be right. one order up.
Or maybe, you know, class, persistence class.
Or something like that.
A lot of shims like that.
But a whole zoo of interesting things, but they're all universal.
That's right.
And now, in my mind, one of the big target audiences of EF are those people. People who create report generators, people who
That's
create
right.
visualization tools, people who can't afford to be specific about a particular schema, but have to be generic over all schemas. How does EF help those folks?
Well, there's a couple ways. One is, let me say something else about the EF, and then I'm going to
answer
the question directly. I can't help myself. One of the things that we found when we set out to build the entity framework, you know, we had the model in hand pretty much,
right.
was that every significant application in the world that talked to a database built the same code at the bottom of that application, and they all fell into the same set of problems.
Mm.
Right? There's all this code at the bottom of the application that talked to the database. It, you know, moved some values around. It reswizzled the ordering. It did buffering. You know, it basically does all these marshaling, unmarshaling things.
Right.
You know, to use the remoting terms.
But it's all the same aspects of the same kind of problem.
That's right. Yeah. Some data access.
You're just layer, moving stuff.
You know, mm-hmm. stuff that deals with the database. Just moving stuff from A to B. You know, I have a friend who calls them boats.
Boats.
You build a bunch of boats to get it to where you're at.
Create, read, update, delete. It's always the same
exactly.
sort of pattern. Yeah.
And they always, when you're building an application, you build enough of that you know your application runs. And you might build it to be a little bit tighter, and you add some more stuff to your application, so you realize you have to do a little bit better job down there. But there's never a lot of impactful value for applications in building out their own framework and that stuff. It's just that's what they got to do, because that's all the database guys have handed them for years.
Right.
So when you look at what all of those things do, the more mature ones all end up with the same kinds of features. They all have some very strong notion of the metadata associated with the data.
Right.
So where's my schemas? What are my types? How is that mapped? Where are the databases?
Yeah. I'd almost call that metadata if you're looking for schemas.
Well, it sort of begs the question.
It does.
Metadata in an application, which, you know, I'm not
meta to the nth power, and then
right.
we just call it meta.
So it turns out that people are building frameworks. People are building design tools, whether they're query builders or natural language integration, or even integration with full-text search, for example.
Right.
They're getting at the same kinds of metadata
yeah.
that today has no systematic underpinning.
Right.
So by way of making the model and the framework sort of applicable to a wide range of databases, you think about the .NET framework today, IDEO.NET, as it's existed for years now, it already talks to lots of different kinds of databases. We
yes.
call this data independence in some ways.
Right.
When we're building any framework, we're conscious of the fact that we wanted to preserve that quality for the framework. You know, we built not just the framework itself to talk to a particular database, but really we thought of it as we're going to build some extensions to the framework so that you can talk to any database, whether
mm-hmm.
it is SQL Server. Hey, great. I love that.
Yep.
Oracle. DB2, MySQL.
Right. And this is similar to the ODBC concept.
Right. There's value in having a strong layer for data independence. And in fact, a lot of those vendors worked with us in the early versions to produce versions. Some of you even released early versions already. So.
Awesome. Yeah.
But that, together with that, the framework guys need the metadata, and we had to generate a bunch of metadata to get the runtime to work, gave us a lot of insight into how to handle the metadata. And how to handle the descriptions of where is the data, what's the storage schema that's
mm-hmm.
underlying it, where do you have to keep that. And so we took that as an opportunity to replumb parts of that stack. And that means that people who write tools over schemas, who write generators, people who are plugging in dynamic languages are an even more interesting case of that in some ways. They're all after a very similar set of things. And we factored a bunch of those into the framework as well. It's not something that you pick up the release and you say, wow, programmer's got X more stuff. But
I can throw away now 300,000 lines of ugly Fleming code.
I mean, there's some of that, but yeah. that's what you're after. But really what I think that enables is that ecosystem of people who can build, domain-specific tools, whether it's tools to integrate better into ASP.NET,
mm-hmm.
tools to integrate into cloud services,
right.
Or query builders, or doing reporting.
Yes.
Query builder type tools on top of that, decision support, all that kind of stuff. There's just a wider path for those guys to stand on for that stuff.
Okay. Well, is it time to go to the whiteboard and show me blocks of things and what it all looks like?
Blocks are great.
Let's do it.
Blocks.
I think we have a good good conceptual idea of where EF is going now.
Well, I
Let's
talked about
what the things are.
Oh boy! So this is one of the first things I learned when I came over to Building 35 at Microsoft. That's how you draw a database.
Yeah, a little drum,
the oil drum.
Nice. And I wonder why that is.
Because in the old days, disks looked like oil drums. They really did. I still remember this giant thing. For all the world, it looked like a front-loading washing machine.
Exactly.
And then the deck ones looked like top-loading washing machines.
Exactly.
You remember these, yeah.
Okay.
In fact, there used to be kind of funny pranks you could play, because if you fed certain kind of programs into, I was going to say card reader, I don't know if I should say that. But,
no, yeah.
You could actually spin the drives in a pattern that would make the deck ones walk.
Wow.
This is known to administrators.
That's right. This was
nice.
This is a standard adolescent prank for your adolescent system staff to pull. And
that's pretty cool, actually.
I guess it would have
software
driving hackers.
Fathers of hackers. Well, they're now fathers of hackers. Yeah. Right, yeah.
Interesting.
Their sons and daughters are working here now.
Boy. So this is sort of our standard entity framework diagram. And we talk about things in a couple different layers. First, there's the stores that you can connect to underneath, and each of these represents a .NET adapter that talks to them. There's several that come with, and there's several more that are being worked on. A couple have been released in early form already. And those plug into what we think of as the provider layer. And this is essentially the same part of the architecture that we had in ADO.NET all along. Right, there's always a data command, data reader. There were always data providers that plugged into that.
Right.
And when you think about what these providers do, they take commands and they send back readers. And they the commands at the standard ADO.NET level are just, you know, strings of SQL.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Select star from customers where name doesn't equal X.
Yeah,
right,
exactly.
Whatever.
That's what they are.
And you get back a reader that honors that command.
Right. The reader is whatever the database decided to send you back. And really, in CLR terms, what the reader is a sort of a handle into the underlying plumbing that does the right buffering and all the magic that means that you get high-speed operation when you're talking over a pipe to a database in the first place.
Now, from my standpoint, does it look like an IE numerable?
Well, what happened in VS 2008 is we went to those things and we made it interesting to be an IE enumerable by adding all of the delayed execution features that we got.
Yes.
Right. So it turns out I think they were always IE enumerable, so they might not have been. That's sort of lost in my memory at the moment. But now it's interesting that they're IE enumerable.
So, yes.
Because that means that you can put them in a for each and they'll just magically
execute. That means
execute
all the link machinery now.
Now, if you look at something like an older style, like an ODBC or an OLADB, you literally had to step through all the results at each layer. And the language has done a good job of hiding that mechanic.
Okay.
The question is, what can we do at the data layer that will that will provide an even better match on that? So we have an interesting demo, and I know this has made it onto a couple of the screencasts that we've done about the entity framework. You know, there's about a 300-line program you can write, which is this basic issue query, get results, printf, you know?
Yes.
And if you walk through systematically, okay, we got this out of being IE enumerable, it starts to shrink, and each stage it shrinks, you can attribute to just one of those.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you think about everybody that's worked on improving the data programming environment that Microsoft provides, every single one of those has some significant reduction in the lines of code,
yes,
which means higher productivity, higher likelihood to just get it right.
Shorter code is better code, period.
Yeah. If you get
almost
the,
always.
If you get the plumbing right.
I'll hedge it with an almost. It's almost always better code.
Definitely in this case. So from the architecture point of view, this is the layer at which all knowledge of what's really happening at the store level, the store-specific knowledge about the path, that's where we encapsulate it.
Got it.
Right? And that means that the stuff that we write above this doesn't know anything about the store underneath except what's encapsulated by that layer.
Perfect.
So you could be SQL 92, you could be SQL 99,
you
could be DB2.
Your provider.
SQL Server. I have an interface to ask you interesting questions, and I don't need to know underneath that.
Right.
And again, it's really just an extension of the existing ADO.NET framework.
Good.
So then this is a piece that has some heavy magic.
Heavy magic, that's cool.
Yeah.
Magic,
that's a good term.
that is a good term, actually.
I like that.
Huh.
And I will defer to the official documentation for what we call this officially, but this is the layer that does mapping.
Yes. Mm.
And it doesn't do all the mapping. Right. What it specifically does is it does what we think of as the mapping of reshaping the data.
Okay.
Right? So if you have a salesperson table, right, that's underneath in the store, normalized out to salesperson, employee, and contact.
Mm-hmm.
This is the thing that understands how to take that schema, how to take the instructions, right, the declarations about how to map that into a single object or into a single entity.
Yes, better. Yes.
It's very easy to slip on that one, by the way.
It is.
And it reshapes them. Now, it doesn't give you an object, right? It stops at the reshaping.
Hmm.
This takes in a...
It doesn't get... Now, let me be make sure I understand this explicitly. It doesn't give you a CLR object. It gives you an entity in the entity framework sense.
That's right.
Is this a little bit like constructing views over entities?
It's much like constructing views over relations.
Over relations. At the bottom, then, correct me if I'm wrong, at the bottom of the mapping layer, we still see relations. And at the top of the mapping layer, we see entities?
Well, let's. I want to be careful about
that for two reasons. Yeah.
Don't
let me oversimplify.
It's very subtle, actually. When I say heavy magic, part of that is in the particular subtleties that we have. So this layer at the bottom, these are conceptual maps, of course. Right?
Yeah, of course.
So what's happening is you're still sending commands and you're picking up readers, right?
And that's what the provider does.
And it also turns out that the mapping layer does that too.
Okay.
At the top, it takes in commands and it sends back readers.
This looks like function composition to me. This makes me happy.
It's sort of incidental, part of the architecture,
right,
as it turns out, but it's a good observation.
Mm-hmm.
What the mapping layer is doing is it's taking those commands and it's literally reshaping them in terms of the instructions that it has about how to map the data back and forth.
Ah, okay.
This is exactly what a view manager does in a database.
Yes.
It is. As
you
it
have
turns
a view
out.
Spec that comes in from the side, and then you reshape the
That's
flow,
right.
the vertical flow.
It's a declaration of how to, you know, produce, it's the queries that produce that view.
Right.
Now, there's a couple things that make it a little bit special. One is it's not a general purpose view manager.
Okay.
Okay?
Good.
Which is good for a couple of reasons. The other thing is that we handle updates in the mapping layer in exactly the same way. So you can think of the reads that come through this path as mapping relations into entities at
yes.
the top.
Yes.
Turns out you can't use that for updates.
Right.
And in formal terms, you can't use it because views are not generally invertible.
Exactly.
You can't compute the inverse of a view from the view itself.
In particular, if your view sums two numbers, you can't tell,
Yep.
3 plus 7 is the same as 6 plus 4, and you've lost whether it's a 3 or a 4 down at the bottom.
So it turns out that the guy that proved that is Phil Bernstein,
yes.
of course, who works here in MSR.
Ah.
Phil did a lot of legwork for many, many years about how to do these kinds of schema manipulations and data reshaping together with Sergey Melnick. And
yes.
those guys had a... it turned out that when we recognized mapping was a core problem for us, those guys had actually been working on it for years and had some insights and some solutions that we were able to actually work with, which was just awesome. I mean, those guys did an outstanding job.
Yes.
In fact, I really should mention for them, Sergey Merlina Atul had a set of papers at SIGMOD last year, really three papers about the entity framework work.
Yeah.
Phil gave the keynote at SIGMOD, talked about the work. Those three papers were all accepted into SIGMOD, and Sergey and Atul's won Best of Show.
Awesome.
Wow.
So
this is Atul Adya, by the way, who's... has he moved back to research?
He's in live, actually.
He's in live now.
Yes.
Atul Adya, Sergey Melnick, and Phil Bernstein.
Yeah.
I worked with them a little bit. Mapping is sort of another mathematical problem that was distinct from the mathematical problem of modeling that I worked on.
Mm-hmm.
But
similar
crossed rate. Paths with them several times, and they were...
Cool.
So when I say heavy magic, I mean, we really had to tap the work here. Thankfully, the work itself had been ongoing at the formal level for quite a while.
For a long time, yeah.
But no one had really taken that kind of work and tried to incarnate it in a runtime system. Mm-hmm. But it's exactly like where we were with views and databases, 18 years ago.
Right.
Until we really had a functioning view management system that really did all the stuff that the theory said it could, you really didn't know if you were going to rely on the programs.
Right.
Okay.
So the trick here, the key insight for how this stuff works is we actually build a mapping correspondence. And you start with here's my rows and tables,
mm-hmm.
right? This is down in my store, and here's the set of entities that we want to get to.
That's your conceptual model out there on the side.
Right. So this is the entity model here. This is my relational. I'm not going to say relational for a reason. I'm going to say row and table for a minute.
Good.
And
now both of those are clean, crisp.
They're well defined.
Formalizable, well defined, well formed. Yeah.
That's right. They're well formed models. And what we do is the mapping is really the act of drawing correspondences between those. So you really end up with three parts of the artifact that the mapping engine runs on. It's a description of the source schema, it's a description of the target conceptual model, and then the description of how to map between them.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And what we do with this at the mathematical level is really simple. We know we can't invert views in general, so we
right.
don't specify this as views. We specify this as a set of correspondences.
Yes.
And then we generate a pair of views from those correspondences.
I see.
One of those views we use for reading.
Okay.
Right? It's a typical view, right? And this is the view that maps the rows and tables into entities.
Yes.
We generate another view for use in the update path.
I see.
And that actually maps entities in terms of rows and tables.
Now, let me try to put this in my simple-minded terms. If my entities have the sum of my two columns and my tables don't, then in the reader one, I add the two numbers, and in the writer one, I remember that I added the two numbers, and I can get backwards.
And how you added it in
how
the proportion.
I added. Good.
It's a little easier to see in normalization, I think, where
right.
you say, okay, I know that my salesperson object is these set of values over here. And when we go back into rows and tables, I know which three tables
I know
insert
how to
those values.
Renormalize. I denormalize and I renormalize.
And in fact, in terms of capturing the correspondences, one of the things we can capture at the update and at the create stage is we capture any of the constraints
yes.
about lifetime that go there. So you don't
oh, lifetime constraints.
Create.
As well as key constraints.
That's right.
Hidden here is the fact that you need to manipulate your primary and foreign key constraints. Because you may turn a one-to-many into a one-to-one
exactly.
and all of that kind of stuff. But you also manipulate lifetime constraints.
Right.
That's interesting.
So
I never thought about that.
Which is nice, because that's all the stuff that's really easy to screw up.
Oh, yeah.
In
yeah.
the application program.
Terrible.
Right. And you can hide it down in the plumbing and say that's a special part of the application. But it's still fragile.
Giant pitfall for people, yeah.
Exactly. So we can encapsulate all that by just capturing the model in the first place. And
okay, good.
You don't have to teach people normalization at the other end, all the good stuff I was talking about. So this really ends up being no harder than writing a view manager for a database, which is sort of an offhand comment.
Yeah, no harder than writing
There's only decades worth of theses about that, some of which...
This is no harder than quantum field theory. I mean, this...
but at least it gave us a way to think about the problem and a way to think we can systemically solve some of these.
Right.
The other thing, I've been careful about using the word relational and entity and row and table.
Yeah.
Really, the way this thing is built is that we take advantage of the fact that the EDM is a proper superset of the relational model itself.
Yes. So that means that every relational model can be embedded faithfully in an EDM model.
Right.
Good.
Unchanged, you can take a relational model.
And just plunk it in and it works.
And conceptually, it's already an ER model by virtue of the fact that the EDM is itself encompassing of the relational model.
Perfect.
So that means that we can actually build the machinery so that the mechanism is that we take an entity model here and we produce an entity model here. It's just that most of the entity models you feed to it are going to be these degenerate, if you will, entity models that are just relational models.
Yeah, okay, good.
Well,
but from the practical standpoint, this means I'm a programmer, I want to get started with the entity model, I have a very pain-free way of getting started.
Right, because we can go read the database catalog.
I don't change anything.
We can bring the database catalog in. We can even give you a default set of assumptions based on the keys that you have set up about your relationships and so forth. And you can start with an entity model that's pre-generated, and then you can go in and tweak from there. Or you can decide that that's good enough for your particular purposes.
Really nice.
It also turns out that database programs are kind of funny, too. There are no new database programs.
Yeah.
There really aren't. You never build a thing that you just go out and build a brand new database program from scratch. What you're really doing, 99.99 times out of, 100. Because that's a percent,
that's
right?
A good
yeah.
Thing, yeah.
Is you're adding on. You're building a database that's talking to an existing application. You're doing some reporting or some maintenance on the side.
Mm-hmm.
Or you're building a new module in an existing programming. Those databases, as I said, they live for decades.
Yes.
So really, what you're looking for there is the ability to go in and derive those models independently and then share those models.
Right.
Right.
Legacy is a really big deal in the database world. It's a sine qua non.
Absolutely. Yeah. And one of the things that this sort of construction gives us from the architecture is it gives us the ability to compose those models.
Good.
And even
good.
The compose models that were built by, you know, say, different organizations, different consultants, different parts of the organization. Now, because there's a limit to how much we're going to ship in this initial version, because that's sort of one of the more advanced things. But we know that architecturally we're well prepared for that.
Composability is the way to make heavy magic out of magic.
That too.
So what exactly, just step back, because, you know, for the people out there who don't spend a lot of time in SQL, and I still think there is a confusion conceptually between entity and object.
Absolutely.
Because, I mean, you even had confused it when you mentioned it.
Yep.
I know that theoretically, big brains like yourselves and Eric Meyer and whatnot, I mean, the question that I'm asking, though, is what the hell is an entity?
Right.
Can we break into that box?
Absolutely.
What is it? What exactly are you producing? What is it? It's not an object. What are you giving me?
What is it?
Yeah, you're giving me an
entity. Table.
It's not a table. It's not a row. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about what is a row.
It's not a reader.
Right?
That's right.
A row is just, you know, a record, right? It's a set of values. And it's basically a record from a table. And what a table means, really, in this case, is it has a well-understood type.
Mm-hmm.
That means that each of these cells, you know, it's a varchar, you know, it's a decimal.
Sure.
You know, it's a string. And so we all sort of understand what a record is, right?
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
And so, the usual object-oriented mapping is to say that a row is an instance, and the table spec is a type, is a class.
Exactly.
That's the usual starting point for OR, and then we go downhill from there.
Yeah. It's great as far as it goes, in much the same way that, you know, structs were very like classes.
Sure.
You know, right?
Yeah.
They're an interesting but degenerate form of the object itself.
Okay.
And in fact, the thing that makes it interesting is you can very directly just map this into entity, and you'll get a very simple entity of exactly analogous kind, right?
So every row is an entity.
Right.
Good.
So every row is itself an entity of this form,
of that
right?
Kind,
at this level, it's very easy. And so when we say that it's a superset of the relational model, this is one of the byproducts that shows that that's true.
Good.
Okay.
They all have some type in here. Right? I'd like to say scalar type, but it turns out not quite to be true anymore. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they all have some interesting type.
Object programmers are not afraid of nesting. Only SQL guys are afraid of nesting.
I'll come back to that.
Okay.
What entity adds on top of this, though, is this notion of inheritance. It adds a notion of composition. And I will say the word association, although you might also say relation, which is the R in entity relation as well. Relation gets really overloaded in terminology, so I usually drop back to association.
Okay, good.
And, you know, the interesting thing about all of these is that you can implement them by convention in a database today.
Absolutely.
In a standard relational model.
Very easy to do.
Right. And so people do. And there's, you know, you have different conventions in different places. You
right.
might have a link table for multi-way associations. You know, you might have discriminator columns for inheritance.
You might have used indices to do this kind of thing.
Yep. All of that is possible in this world. So to answer your question more directly, Charles, what we've got here is just complex records. That's all an entity really is at the end of the day.
Okay.
You can shut that off. Thanks.
I don't know how to do it. Just hit ignore.
Yeah,
that's fine.
Yeah, there you go. Sorry about that.
Not a problem at all. It's real. This is real, man.
This is real life.
Real reality.
Real life.
All right.
So these entities are just rows in the standard way, and all the way that you think about rows, they're an instance of some data in a table. They belong to a particular type. Is true of this in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's kind of a funny thing. We can say entity, and we can say entity collection.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason we use those words is because row and table were taken, but they occupy the same sort of notional space.
Interesting.
in the model, these are pretty straightforward. Mm-hmm. The real trick is that there's a lot of different ways to map these more complicated things into rows and tables as they exist today.
Sure.
And you know, these three things do beg the question, which you brought up before, of what is your identity system and
yes.
how do you handle keys? And keys are so common, of course, that you know people forget they're not in the original relational model. They're sort of a layer above the original relational model.
Yes.
If you look at these things, we're really just keeping that layering going in that sense.
Yes.
So you can think of an entity as a row with ID. You know, there's an ID that is baked into it, a primary key ID.
And that's a requirement for an entity.
It is a requirement for an entity.
And I think that's a good thing. I've always thought that the relational model, in its treatment of keys, it was sort of as though they said, well, we want relations to be like relations from set theory, and we'll just assume that we can tell things apart. Because the only question in set theory is, does an element belong to the set?
Right.
And if you forget if you forget this notion of keys, you don't have any way to answer that question. And so it's as though the database guy said, oops, we forgot about how to identify things to tell whether they're in our tables.
It's an exercise left to the reader.
Exactly.
Every program.
So from the mathematical hygiene point of view, requiring your entities to have a primary key, instead of it being this bolt-on constraint, is a really good thing.
Right, and again, people already do it by convention. Nobody writes without keys.
Of course,
but they're.
But now it's baked into the formalism, and that makes it a better formalism from my point of view.
Right, we take advantage of
yeah.
it now because it's part of the mechanism. Did I wander too far afield, or have I started?
No, that's great. I mean, you definitely have started answering the question. It's just when I think about what I get back
mm-hmm.
from my. So if I'm writing an imperative like C sharp
right.
thing, and I say. You know,
so let me
give
talk
me a bunch
about
of entities.
This box just a little bit, Charles.
Good, that's good.
Because after we've reshaped the data, there's some layer here, and this mm-hmm. layer's function is to take the reshaped data and to make objects out of it, right? Mm-hmm. And it really has to do a couple things. One thing it does is it actually assembles the CLR objects. It gives them object identity.
Mm-hmm.
It manages the state.
This is object
objects.
Identity distinct from the memory address of the object, which is how the CLR
exactly.
has this implicit notion of identity.
That's right.
You've got an extra notion of identity.
Actually, we map the entity notion of identity to the CLR
Beautiful.
Identity.
Okay, good. Mm.
And one of the really tricky parts here is I can go up here and draw an architecture with four layers of boxes.
Mm-hmm.
But if that means four layers of indirection in the actual runtime,
mm-hmm.
You're going to hurt.
Yeah, we're
not
going to
scale.
No one's ever going to use it, right? I mean, no one in their right mind would ever use it. And that was one of the things that actually building it, as opposed to having the mathematical model itself,
yes.
That's really been the journey, is to how can we make those layers work the way they're supposed to work and still have it be, blindingly fast when it comes to working with databases, which is just a key requirement.
I'm trying to pin down, by the way,
requirement.
I'm trying to pin down some of the engineers and have a chalk talk like this about how they did that.
That's another thing
I want to know about.
There is some really deep magic.
That's where the hard work has been in the last couple of years.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
You just have to be religious about performance.
I just got to get somebody who isn't afraid to get in front of a camera with me.
Got it. This is great. I think this is important to point out because we didn't talk about this at the beginning, but Brian will be taking us on a little journey once in a while when he's not doing his day job of writing code and whatever other crazy things you're coming up with.
Proving people wrong.
Or proving them right.
Proving people right, yeah. You're going to actually come and do what you're doing today, lead these interviews with engineers and architects and technical people across the company in this realm.
Cutting
this
to
is
the
actually a new thing.
Yes.
It's a very new concept for Channel 9. It's great.
I like to call it cutting to the bone. Let's get
cool.
down there and...
And you're cool with that, right, Sam?
I'm happy about it. You know, it's nothing customers aren't going to run into, and I'd rather, you know, talk about it and have the conversation about it, the whole thing. I mean,
but cool. All joking aside,
yeah.
by bringing my oddball perspective to things and asking people, inviting people.
Yeah, you're not
people.
That.
But inviting people to try to explain it to me, that's what I want to do. And
cool.
I, you know, my promise in this process is that I promise never to ask a question if I already know the answer.
Good.
All my questions are genuine.
Good. See, that's
okay.
one of the key things for having a conversation with someone.
But you got to explain it to me.
Sure. Well, that's good, because then your perspective would be different from, say, somebody who is not an expert in any specific technical domain, or math, or physics, or...
Well, right, and I'm always going to try to put it into this kind of mathematical framework,
great,
because that's the way I see the world.
Of course. And everything is math by Brian
Everything
Beckman.
Has got to be math, otherwise I can't believe in it. You know?
It still amazes me that he can be so rigorous on the math and yet talk to normal human beings.
Exactly.
Pretty amazing.
And really love things like VB and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah, love VB and love entity framework.
Cool. Right?
That's why we're here.
Because those are like...
No. Make math practical.
Yeah.
Yes, cool. Sir. All right. So we're... You know, we
I don't want to be enforced on something.
So, we're back to the top box.
Right. And so, you know, locally we call this the object services layer. And really, this is the default CLR programming model that you build on top of entities. Now, I kind of mentioned this before, but this is built because we expect multiple programming models could be built over that reshaped entity data in the entity framework itself. And it's important to remember, the entity framework is the thing that doesn't run in the database, by definition. It's the thing that runs in the mid-tier. It's the thing that runs in a client application.
I see, right.
Right? So I'm not talking about how we build the stored procedures for it. I mean, we could host this back into the SQL CLR layer and provide those services, but there may be a more direct way to provide the services in that layer. We're really talking about how we build these programs that are handling data outside of the database. And this is kind of a new concept for database people to think about deeply, too, because the database is the database. And, you know, however people build apps, they build apps. SQL's good. Here's the manual.
Yeah.
Go for it.
Right?
Yeah. But what we're trying to do here is provide these services. The, one of the probably really exciting things that we haven't been able to talk much about is how having these formal models and these service layers over those runtime pieces that incarnate the model enables you to do other kinds of programming in the same way. I mean, I talked about the fact that every application for databases in the world, they have the same bottom layer. Well, it turns out that everybody who builds a service between the application or some component between the application and the database builds the same model.
Yeah.
So if you build you know, a reporting service over databases, you're going to go build some framework pieces, and you're going to specify queries that have that denormalized form of the customer.
Right.
And you're going to specify some other queries that talk about the relationship between customers and their orders, line items and the order that originates from. And you're basically reinventing all of that goo in each of that, you know, each instance of that framework.
Right.
And then you can go over to, say, replication or sync. And you can think, okay.
Same kind of problem.
I'm gonna ship my logs back and forth, and that's gonna give me the orders table. Well, how many orders do I have to get to have a complete, or how many line items do I have to ship over to get a complete order?
Right.
Well, I have to specify a query to the replication system that says either give me all or none of those.
Right.
Well, that is sort of exactly the same mapping correspondence.
Then you start building a higher level query language for the replication service, and it gets all messy. Yeah.
And so you start building each of these little models sort of amongst all the services that you might want to provide, whether it's sync or reporting, load and unload, bulk transform. I mean, you can kind of go down the list, and everybody's sort of trying to get a higher level semantic handle on the data as it stands. And this is sort of the foundation for what we'd like to be the lingua franca for all of the services that we can provide post-data.
Let me make sure now I understand. This critter here is the high-performance way of translating entities into objects.
That's right.
Now, one of the things that we were talking about before is the difference between a completely generic or universal representation for objects versus a specific one, an actual class customer. Do you get both of those in here, or...?
You can, depending on how you use the metadata. It's easy. The easiest case to think about is the case where you take the model and you just, you know, you generate a bunch of code that generates your CLR classes. You can use things like partial methods to. Implement business.
Okay, this is nothing bolts. It doesn't actually generate IL. It generates source code for you.
That's right.
Okay, good.
That's right. It's a standard sort of Visual Studio code generation, code behind.
Just like WinForms.
Kind of just like WinForms or any of the other ones we can mention. So it fits very nicely in that. You don't really write three parts of schema metadata either. You really sort of generate one file and you edit the three sections. But, you know, those are sort of nuts and bolts.
This brings up the question of how do you create the artifacts that drive this process? Here's a description of your rows and tables. That's already in the SQL schema language. here's a description of entities. You've got to have some precise way of doing that. And then you have to have a precise way of specifying the mapping.
So really there's...
And from the programmer's point of view, how do I go to work and do this? I want to do one of these.
So so for example, if you install the entity framework with the Visual Studio tools, what you get is the runtime package, and you get a new project.
Okay. Project templates.
Templates.
Okay, good.
Mm-hmm. Select a new EF project.
Oh, nice.
And we've done screencasts on this before, too, for people who might have seen some of that.
Where are those screencasts hosted? MSDN?
They're on MSDN. Okay. Best way to get to them is actually to hit our main blog for the data team.
Uh-huh.
It's blogs.msdn.com/data.
Great.
It's slash data. It's
super.
That easy.
Super.
You can also go to msdn.com/data and get all the downloads for the runtime pieces, the tools pieces, and all the other pieces that we put together.
Or you can just use live search.
Live search, also. Absolutely. But anyway, we do keep the data page up to date,
good,
which is nice.
So now, but that brings that does beg a question.
Greatest.
So, because you mentioned live search,
I did.
Now, I would ask you: are there around the company?
Mm-hmm.
We're a company with lots of software engineers and a company with that programs against a lot of data.
Yeah.
How are they? What's their feedback to this? I mean, how's the dog fooding going?
I'm super excited about the dog fooding. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. it's hard to talk about that
on behalf
of those other teams that have made their own build-buy decisions.
Uh-huh.
It absolutely has been true that every significant application, including all of the ones that we built inside Microsoft, mm-hmm. had already built their own layer.
Yes.
Okay.
So, most of these guys, you're really talking about, hey, can we rip out the bottom guts of your program and insert our brand new stuff for you?
Betcha. Yeah, right.
So it is, it's not an easy sell. The trick for us, I think I always felt like we'd have a successful product if we knew that people were willing to take that chance,
mm-hmm.
and they'd see the compelling benefit for doing so.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm actually pretty happy because we've got some very significant guys who are doing that. I can't speak on their behalf.
That's fine.
Publicly. But I'm happy about that, and we've gotten just a tremendous amount of interest from real customers, outside the Microsoft umbrella as well,
mm-hmm.
Who really even started adopting before I think we were completely 100% prepared for that.
Yeah.
In the CTP process.
Marvelous.
We even have people who.
No, the fact that they're still interested after the CTP process means you must have done something.
Sure. Absolutely.
It's just nice to see those parts of the puzzle come together. We've had a lot of good feedback on the forums and the blogs as well. I think the most interesting piece is how the tools have come together.
Mm.
It's hard to understand the theoretical model, when you've got some whiteboard and you've got a schema spec in Bacchus and Oriform. But when you actually load up Visual Studio and you see the entity designer, and the thing reads the storage schema for you, and you see the schema and the designer, and you start building correspondences, as the tools have come together, a lot more people have seen it, and a lot more people have really responded to it.
Now, roughly how long would it take me as a semi-educated user to open the box, plug in a CD, and get my first entity framework model running?
The Project Wizard we started talking about before, that has a piece that will go in and actually read your catalog. It'll generate that default entity model for it by making those assumptions.
Yep.
It comes up in Visual Studio. There's an edit experience for it. There's a design experience for it. You can really get started, within a few minutes of opening the box.
Super.
With a straightforward database.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, in the real world, we don't get straightforward databases.
Yeah.
No.
And so then we get to the more nuanced discussion of, okay, how fast can I get started in a SAP installation or something?
Mm-hmm.
That's a much different deal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Something the size of, AdventureWorks, for example, it's a minute.
Super.
So
that's
lovely.
You can start there.
All right.
Well, this is great.
How are we doing on time?
I think it's time for conclusion.
All right. Conclusion is... Sam, thanks a lot. You guys have done a tremendous amount of work from my little worm's eye view downstairs working on my little math problems. I hear you guys banging the hammers and, the pickaxes on the rocks upstairs and drilling. And it's been great to see this come together. And I'm very happy that you took the time out to show me how it all works and what it all means.
Well, thanks for the opportunity. The team's been working hard, and we're super excited about it.
Excellent. Thanks again.
Thanks, Brian.
Cool. Thank you. See you next week.
Yes, indeed.